Okay, Ed Buckler asked me to come here today to give this talk, and I was happy to do it, happy to be here. I guess it's been a little while since I've been to a CSSA meeting. So, at any rate, today I'm going to speak about a technique that was developed in our lab by Rob Elsher. It's a technique for doing reduced representation sequencing for rapidly genotyping highly diverse species. I want to start out with a little background. So anytime that you're dealing with an organism that has a very large genome like maize, you have to do something to decrease genome complexity. There's kind of two schools of thought for doing that. And one is to enrich, do target enrichment. And these include techniques like various PCR techniques for pulling out specific genes or genomic subsets, molecular inversion probes, and the sequence capture approaches like hybridization-based microarray things. And what we've decided to do actually is to use restriction enzymes to reduce genome representation. And it's kind of a no-brainer because technically it's a lot less challenging than these other techniques. And you can also use methylation-sensitive enzymes to filter out a lot of the repetitive genomic fraction. The way things are looking these days, at least with genes in maize and probably everything else too, for things like VGT1, TB, or B genes of maize, the regulatory regions are far, far away from the actual coding sequence. So here I have a cartoon of a gene, exons down here, and here's your regulatory region here far, far away. So if you rely on techniques that involve exon capture, you're never going to touch the regulatory region. But if you can map enough markers, a large number of genome-wide markers, you will tag this region eventually. So basically, our goal is to create a public genotyping informatics platform based on next-gen sequencing. What I'm going to concentrate on today is this first little block here, which is the creation of an inexpensive, robust multiplex sequencing protocol. And so all this is predicated on using low-coverage sequencing with Illumina technology is the technology we've chosen. And this goes in, these data go into an informatics pipeline, which then anchors the markers across the genome and missing data is imputed. And then these genotypic data are combined with the phenotypic data for either genomic selection or genome-wide association studies. Oops. Okay, so the protocol that we've developed is, we're calling it genotyping by sequencing, or GBS. There's another acronym for the literature. It's a simple, highly multiplex system for constructing libraries for next-generation sequencing. And it involves reduced sample handling, very few PCR and purification steps, no DNA size fragmentation, and an efficient barcoding system. Now we have, right now we're doing this protocol in 96-plex, and if anyone is interested in a detailed protocol, it's available at this URL. So basically the first thing we do is we plate out individual DNA samples and adapter pairs. I want to say something about the adapters that we use for this protocol because they're different from the Illumina adapters. The barcode is actually contained on one of the adapters. We call this the barcode adapter. And the barcode, the length of the barcode varies from four to eight base pairs. And then they're sticking ends that are compatible to whatever restriction enzyme that we use to digest the DNA with. And there are other primer sequences. This is a common adapter. It does not contain a barcode. And there are primer sequences that basically contribute for downstream PCR applications in Illumina sequencing. So after the DNA is plated, we then digest with the restriction enzyme and ligate adapters. And this step may be done simultaneously, depending on whether or not the temperature profiles of your restriction enzyme and ligase are similar. Right now, the sort of enzyme of favor in our lab is APKE1, which is a 5-base cutter that recognizes a degenerate restriction site. So after the DNAs are plated, digested, and the adapters ligated, they're pooled. And then primers are added, and there's a PCR step to amplify these pooled fragments. So this is different than what, say, someone who's using a Illumina system would be experiencing, because since the adapters in Illumina are added by PCR, at this point there would have been 96 PCRs. And in this step, this protocol, we only have one PCR. So after the PCR is done, there's a cleanup step, and then we always look at the library to see what the fragment size distribution is like. So this is an output from an Experion. This is fluorescence intensity here, and time this way. And this is like, if we got a library that looked like this, we wouldn't be very happy with it. These are size standards here. This is the library itself. And this is an adapter dimer peak. This actually is an unincorporated primer from the previous PCR step. So there's a really big adapter dimer peak. So if we get a library that looks like this, what we do is we go back, and this only has to be done once with a few samples. But we go back and then we perform a titration to find out what's the minimum amount of adapter that will actually function. And once we've done the titrations, we empirically evaluate them. And this is basically, you can see here that the adapter dimer peak has disappeared. So as a result of this titration, our sequencing data, the adapter dimers are only constituting about a half or 0.05% of the raw sequence data. So it's working very well. Another interesting thing about these APKE1 libraries is that they're naturally enriched for small fragment sizes. This is a virtual digest of the B73 genome with APKE1 with the orange markers. And then these are results from one of the maize mapping populations that we've assayed. So these are the proportion or the percent of fragments that fall in various size bins. So you can see here that at least from, say, about 100 base pairs up to maybe 250 in the libraries, these fragments are enriched, which is a good thing because these are the size fragments that are optimal for the Illumina sequencing system. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how our protocol differs from the Illumina protocol. In order to do that, I'm going to have to give some information about how the Illumina system works. So if you look here, this is a piece of a fragment from the Illumina system that's actually attached to a solid surface. If you kind of go backwards, this is actually one of a cluster of fragments that are produced to basically amplify the signal, the sequencing signal. And then this is actually what the Illumina flow cell looks like when it's imaged by the imaging software. So in the Illumina system, the barcode is located down here near where the DNA fragment is attached to the flow cell. So basically, there are two sequencing reactions that are done. Oops. So there's a read up here that actually captures the insert DNA sequence. And then there's a second read that's done to actually read the barcode. In our system, the barcode is actually located up here near the beginning or near the end of the fragment. So there's only one sequencing read that's done. And so basically you read through the barcode, through the cut site, and into the insert. Now this can cause some problems with the phasing algorithm, the sequence phasing algorithm that Illumina uses. So basically, when you have this cluster of fragments, and you want them to be in phase, so you want them basically to be blinking the same color at the same time. So in this case, this group of fragments here are in phase because they're showing the same color or the same nucleotide. So it's really easy to identify that, okay, that's a T, and then you get, you know, a good image. If they're out of phase, that is, if some of the fragments are being, the sequence is either a little bit ahead or a little bit behind where it should be, you get a situation like this where you get an intensity that you don't really know if, what the base is. So in this case, there could be mistakes of base pair calling. It's almost like the system's colorblind. So what we've done to solve this problem is vary the length of the barcode. And what that does, the phasing algorithm for Illumina uses the first 12 nucleotides that it reads to correct for phasing. And the algorithm assumes that there's a random distribution of nucleotides in those first 12 bases. With our system, the restriction cut site, actually, those are not random bases. So what we've done is we've varied the length of the barcode, which pretty much moves the cut site, and also through good design of the barcode itself, we eliminate that problem. These are some results that we've gotten from maize. Kind of the first thing that our bioinformatics people noticed was that if you use the Illumina filter, the Illumina software, to filter the raw reads, you lose a lot of good sequences. So here, these are the unfiltered files. They're called QSeq files. Basically, the sort of hallmark of a good sequence is if the read actually has a barcode and a cut site. And with the unfiltered reads, about 83% of them have a barcode and a cut site. So 17% of them don't, so those would be discarded immediately. With the Illumina filtered files, the FASTQ files, basically a larger proportion have a barcode and a cut site, but they've gone ahead and thrown away 30% of really good reads. And these reads actually align to the maize genome, to single locations, they're really good reads, so they just get tossed immediately. As far as what these sequences align to, the maize sequences, we ran B73 sequence against the B73 reference genome. And this was a total of about 500,000 filtered reads. And we've thrown away things that didn't align to the genome here. So if what's left, 78% actually align to single sites. And then there's another 13% that align to not very many sites. So these actually may contain useful markers. And then there's 9% that are pretty repetitive, so these would get tossed away. As far as sequence coverage goes, this is one of our maize 96-plex, and this is from the NAM population, I do believe. At any rate, as far as how well the sequences, how many reads you get per sample, how consistent that is across the lane, there's variation, obviously. The coefficient of variation here is about 0.35. But considering, that's not too bad. So this would be not optimal, but acceptable. And mapping results, just to give you some numbers with the IBM population, for 276 reels, I believe, there were about 800,000 sequences that with the barcode cut site and occurred greater than 5 times and aligned to a single site. And this represents about 2.3% of the maize genome. And I should say that this data came from a single flow cell. So these are 7 lanes of data from 1 alumina flow cell. From this, we mapped about 25,000 biallelic SNPs. Then we created a new reference genome, reference map based on those SNPs. And there were reads that did not have an alternative allele, and there was like 500,000 of these. And these are obviously a lot more frequent than the biallelic SNPs, but we could map about 1/3 of those as dominant markers. And to check the accuracy of this, we aligned these reads back to the maize genome, and the physical and the genetic positions of the dominant markers agreed 91% of the time. And it's probably really higher than that because there is some, I guess, mistakes in the way that the backs are aligned in the maize genome. Oops. This is sort of, Ben Hahn's already talked about this, but this is just to illustrate the imputation that's going on in the Buckler lab. These are 3,000 SNPs. From chromosome 9, these are 205 IBM rills, and each line here represents a different rill. B73 is coded in blue, MO17 in red, and then the gray is missing. So when these data are imputed, you can see the haplotype structure is like really quite nice. And I think at least for these mapping populations, the imputation accuracy is greater than 99%. Now we've also done some preliminary work with barley, and Jesse Poland, who's here today, did this work in our lab. And this represents like one lane on an alumina sequencer. And Jesse had a mapping population, the Oregon bull barley population, and he chose 43 different rills that basically maximize recombination in this population. So this is, like I said, a 43-plex. You can see here, just by eyeballing the number of reads per sample, that the coverage here is a lot, it's more even than the maize 96-plex. About 98% of his samples had at least 200,000 reads. I think the coefficient of variation was somewhere around 0.2. At any rate, barley has a genome that's, if I remember correctly, about 4 times the size of maize. So this works well for other large genome species, including maize. So the barley mapping results, now remember barley has no reference genome. There were 2.1 million reads that occurred 5 times and were present in more than 20% of the rills. The biallelic SNPs that were mapped to the framework map that Jesse had was 436 of those were mapped. Then another reference genome was generated. And then the dominant markers, he was able to map about 24,000 dominant markers. So from one sequencing lane, Jesse mapped basically 25,000 sequence tags. So 25,000 new markers in barley. Jesse also did he also looked at whether or not the SNPs validated in the sense of, did they show up in the, you know, as were they accurately called as to parent of origin? And so I guess this is a map from one of his individuals in the population. And 99% of the SNPs agreed on parental origin. And in this map right here, the GBS markers are the little downturned triangles, and the reference markers are the upturned triangles. And then as far as the chromosomal segments go, red is parent 2 and blue is parent 1. Costs, which everybody is interested in. Here I've broken down the cost per DNA sample at various multiplex levels. And I've broken it down to how much cost is due to sequencing cost, how much is labor cost, and how much is reagent cost. And depending on the number of samples in your multiplex, at 48 plex, you can see, well, at any plex, you can see that the reagent costs are fairly stable. We might be able to get this to go down a little bit, but probably not much. However, the sequencing cost, which is the majority of the cost, particularly at lower plex levels, and labor, there's an economy of scale. And so for 48 plex, it's costing us right now, and this includes labor, about $33 a sample. $19 for 96 plex, and around $9 for 384 plex. And we're doing 96 plex now and should be up to 384 plex by sometime early in next year. So the take home, and I've heard other people make this point at this meeting, is that genotyping is now less expensive than field trials. You can get a lot of information in a very short period of time for not too much money. You can get, say, 25 megabase pairs of DNA sequence per sample, and there's, for maize, around 126,000 variants per sample. And like I said before, it's about $19 for a 96 plex and about $9 for a 384 plex. In comparison to field trials per sample, field trials right now, and these data came from Ed, he certainly knows more about what field trials cost than I do, are $20 per single location per sample and somewhere around $100 to $200 for multiple locations. So the point is, genotyping is now, it's now maybe possible if you're doing genomic selection to replace some of the field trials with genotypic data, depending on how well genotype predicts phenotype. So a lot of people ask me this: what is the most significant technical issue that we've come across? And without any doubt, it's DNA quality. Whenever you're cutting DNA with a restriction enzyme, you have to have really good DNA. And another issue has been accurate DNA quantification. The variation in the number of reads you get per sample is not a function of how good the barcode is. It's more of a function of how accurate your DNA quantification was. So DNA quality and DNA quantification accuracy are definitely the most significant technical issues, as usual. And these are the people that are members of Ed Buckler's lab who've worked on this project: Rob Elsher and Ken Kawamoto developed the technique in the lab. Jeff Globitz and Chi Soon were the bioinformatics arm, and of course, Ed Buckler. Okay, does anybody have any questions?
Any questions for Sharon?
I see a lot of variation for wheat, for sample, barcode sample.
Yeah.
Is that any linkage to the way you do the DNA pool?
No. Well, I guess in a way, it's more of a function of the how well the DNA was quantified. High molecular weight DNA, it's hard to quantify, and we've tried different methods of quantifying it. We've tried spectroscopy, we've tried intercalating dyes, we've tried a lot of ways, and because high molecular weight DNA is, if it's concentrated, it's kind of gooey. It's hard to pipette it well, too. So we're definitely sure it's not a barcode issue. It's definitely has to do with how the DNA is quantified.
Do you have any preference as to whether to use methylation sensitive or non-sensitive enzymes? Is it possible that you have some areas of the genome that are not covered by your markers if you use methylation sensitive?
Well, definitely. That was part of the point. We're using methylation sensitive enzymes to restrict the amount of repetitive DNA that we're actually assaying. But certainly, if you wanted to use the same enzyme and not have, you know, methylation sensitivity involved at all, you could do a whole genome amplification, and then you wouldn't have any methylated DNA. So yes, there's parts of the genome that this particular enzyme doesn't sample. So, I mean, you can use non-methylation-sensitive enzymes, and we plan on doing some experiments doing that as well.
With multiplexing at higher levels, would your preference be to just make more barcodes and do single read sequencing, or to reuse your barcodes on and do barcodes on either end?
We would just make more barcodes, I think.
Mark, in your dominant reads, is that because of the loss of the restriction site in one of the parents, or is there something else going on?
These are just reads that basically there's no allele for. So, I mean, they're just a sequence that appears, you know, kind of like an AFLP fragment. You don't really know what it's, you know, if there's no allele.
So, possibly an indel or something like that?
No, I think they're real sequences that just we either haven't picked up the allele or one doesn't exist. Like, you know, maize particularly, there are a lot of DNA fragments that exist in one line and not another. So, yep.
I mean, finally, it's amazing to see that, presence, absence also show up many times.
Yeah.
Has that been confirmed that the sequencing of the two, matching pairs? So
I don't think, well, Jesse actually is sitting here and he did that work, so.
Yeah, we have that confirmed. We're using some different sets now.
True.
Do you know why, what's specific about those 30% of the reads that Illumina throws out during the filtering process?
Well, we think that the Illumina quality scores don't mean very much. I mean, they're thrown out based on quality score. But if you go back and if you look at them, there are 84 base pair reads, and we trim them to 64, and we can't find anything wrong with them. But for some reason, they're failing the quality score. And I don't know enough about how the quality score is actually generated to know what's the fatal flaw, but
they don't have a higher error rate when you align them to the V73 genomic sequence.
No.
Any other questions for Sharon?
Well, you get from Wallace a little more information about the very backward. You say that you just have a sub-started to use the different name for the backward.
Yes.
And that to avoid some of the issues that you say.
Yeah. Right. Well, the reason that we vary the barcode length, it all has to do with the position of the barcode actually on the fragment that's being sequenced, and the fact that the restriction site causes, they're not random base pairs. You know, there are four nucleotides in a row that are the same in every single read, and because they are the same, it messes up the phasing algorithm. It affects the phasing algorithm in the Illumina software. So we vary the length of the barcode so we can get more of a random nucleotide distribution in those first 12 bases.
So is that when you make the adapter? You
have
a population of different length adapters that are ligated at one time?
Oh, yeah, I guess so. They're a little bit different. I mean, it's maybe four base pairs in size.
So the answer to your question here, Steve, is that in a pool, okay, so you have a pool of 48 or 96. When you look across the pool, that variation between the lengths of the barcodes and the individual base pair composition at each step in the barcode then produces essentially a random nucleotide distribution in those first 12 bases of the
So 96.
This is not within the sample, but across the pool of sample.
Yep.
Do you incorporate some sort of self-check system into your barcodes to know if there's mistakes, where you can get mistakes?
There are no further questions. I want to thank all the morning speakers. We have a time for a break here.